found this quite appalling. And on the only systems and failures of the systems in the department, what is this? I'd like to know specifically, what is the current status of the PAVS system? And what is the implementation and maintenance position with regards to the system? And then the CRT system, the court recording system, what is the current status of the system? I'm told reliably that there is no maintenance contract in place for these systems, upon which every court in the country relies, that breakdowns are consistent, and that no repairs have been done since September. I'm told that the CCTV system in the court is in the same position, and that if the CRT system breaks down or is full, then it can no longer function. And then the courts grind to a halt. Everything must be done longhand. And, I mean, we can all just sit here and appreciate the consequences of that. So I want specific answers on those two issues. Infrastructure, to tell us that it's dilapidated and is incapable of dispensing justice, to hear this from the Department of Justice is, again, appalling. Courts don't become dilapidated overnight. Why was this allowed to happen? Nobody blaming the Department of Public Works. It's the Department of Justice's business to interact with Public Works and make sure that this doesn't happen. Victoria Magistrates Court burnt down more than 10 years ago. It has not been repaired. Why? We all saw the pictures on social media and elsewhere of the courts in Limpopo and Mpumalanga and in the Northwest where the courts were an abomination. And not only could you not allow members of the public to go there, but prosecutors, magistrates, court personnel have to work there. And there isn't one functioning toilet in the building. How does that work? It's not possible. And the Department of Justice cannot not be aware of this. It's their business to be aware of it. The other issues were covered. A rather glib report was given about backlogs in the Master's Office in the Criminal Court and that the strategy was being implemented to deal with it. I'd like to know what the strategy is, the details of that strategy. It's no good just saying a strategy is being developed to deal with it. Those backlogs are not new. They were certainly exacerbated by the ransomware attack, but they've been there for years. What is the strategy to deal with it, pray tell? Because we don't see any evidence of it. And then these master classes, EXCO master class, part of project management master, what on earth are those things? And a course on cyber attacks, and what are those things? Now, please, I'd like more detail on what those are. I've seen that if you're part of EXCO, you shouldn't be needing any kind of master classes. And if you need part of project management abilities, then you employ somebody who has those abilities. I don't know what these master class things are. I'd like more information on that, please. Also on what they cost. And then there's a slide, I think it was 29. That evidence of achievements in the opinion of the Auditor General can't be backed up by the evidence. That's extremely worrying. This is not, this is the Department of Justice. How can they claim achievements that they can't back up with evidence? I really do need a better explanation of that little scenario. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Paitemba. Can I suggest the following, because I also have a number of questions, but can I suggest that we allow Deputy Minister to respond to the questions that we have asked to him so that he can be able to leave at 12. And once he has done, then we'll come back to this question and answer, because I also have some questions that need to be answered. Is that in order, members? Chairperson, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Yeah, I'm attending or making a speech at the virtual, or at I'm making a speech virtually at the end of term function for the information regulator. It was meant to be at 11:45. They are, however, running late. They haven't started yet. So can I suggest you carry on with the questions? Maybe if I can, if it's getting close, the problem is when I need to respond to the questions here, that doesn't conflict with the moment that I'm giving the virtual speech. So if you can carry on with the questions, but if I can indicate to you if it looks like such a clash is going to happen and can I be included, but at the moment they've only just started and I think it was meant to take 45 minutes before I was to speak. So carry on, Chair, for now, I would suggest.
Okay, no, that's fine. No, thank you very much, Deputy Minister, for that. I have some few questions on my side. One of them is, how many people did you lose as a result of COVID-19 pandemic in the whole department? That would be the first question. The second one, pardon me, I always have a difficulty of reading my own writing. So sometimes I'll be a little bit slow. So you have spent 94.9% to achieve 66% of the results. But the budget that you have spent is 94.9%. You are achieving 66% of the reduced targets. For instance, there are targets like, which it's a problem why they would be reduced. There are targets like appointment of women to SMS. It was reduced from 48 to 46. We still underachieved. There's a target that was reduced also of accepting or recruiting people with disability. Others were removed. But you only achieved 66% when you have spent 94.9% of the budget. Now, this 66%. I mean, it's a great, it's an improvement from the last report of 51%. But if we have to celebrate that you have made an improvement by achieving 66% compared to the 51%, but the report of the Auditor General creates some worries for us about the 66%, because one of your biggest branches, which is court services, that is where the information and performance was found to be unreliable. It was found to be unreliable, which really, for me, it creates a bit of a problem about whatever percentage you would say you would have achieved, especially in court, in the court services side. You have also, there are 33 members who have not signed performance agreement. It's the same problem we had with correctional services, although theirs is too high, but it's a big problem for us. For instance, DG, you are the accounting officer. The minister has signed the performance contract with you. He has signed the performance contract with the president. So if there are people below you who are not signing their performance contract, how are you going to translate your performance contract into deliverables? and what has been done with respect to those 33 people who did not sign a performance agreement. I was informed that in the Western Cape, in Cape Town in particular, the office of the state attorney for more than a year does not have printing machines. And as a result, litigants are forced to print at 4 rand a page, and sometimes those documents cost to hundreds, even thousands of pages. Why there are no printing machines in the Western Cape, in the office of the attorney, state attorney in the Western Cape? Because that is very unfair to people who would want to print, and especially the litigants. You are talking about DG Justice Modernization Program, but yet you spent 59.3% of the budget on that. And there was also an under expenditure of 189 million on computer services. Now, if we are really serious about court modernization, about the fourth industrial revolution, why are we not ensuring that we put our money where our mouths are? Because if you are underspending on that area, court modernization, issues of computers, there is no way you would be able to catch up, even with the analogy that you use, that we are dealing with a house that has been bombed. In order to rebuild that house or to build a new one, you must be able to spend. But if there is such a high under expenditure, how should we trust that you will be able to do that? The Auditor General has found that you have paid prices that were in excess of the prescribed prices in PPEs, and we have picked up that in correctional services. We are also picking up that with yourselves. And it also says that you also procured PPEs through quotations that did not comply with local content. It's the same issue we identified with correctional services, and we're identifying it with yourselves. Because our issue is that if you buy things without verifying local content, I mean, you're contradicting the industrial policy of the country. How are we going to industrialize if we're not promoting a South African produced goods? So once the Department of Trade and Industry cannot say one thing and the Department of Justice and Correctional Services and do the other, and then expect that you will have an industrialized South Africa, it can't work. There is also an issue that is raised that there is poor security of bid records, which is very serious. In the void, resulting in a loss of records. You have appointed a consultant to deal with gender mainstreaming at a cost of just over R1 million. Was there anyone, there was no one in the department who could do that for you to go and get a consultant to do gender mainstreaming? I would like to get an explanation. Even under regular expenditure, there is still a regular expenditure that is under assessment of 999 million, and in that it includes contract to the value of 859 million, which were awarded to service providers which submitted fraudulent mandatory bid documents. How far are you with that kind of an investigation? How soon can you provide us with an update with regards to that investigation? There's a court that it's written here. It's a new court, the magistrate court in Kaluyaha. It's a new court, but already the bathrooms are not working, and the ceilings are rusty. And it's one thing that we are picking it up as a trend. There are problems around the courts in Bombela. There are problems around the courts in Bulukwane, newly built courts. Now, as a client to Public Works, don't you, before occupation, don't you do verification with Public Works that what you have paid for is fit for purpose? And then I think the last one, this community rehabilitation project that was removed from the APP, are you still considering doing it again? And if yes, when are you going to ensure that it starts again? Those are the few questions from my side, DJ. Thank you. Maybe you can start, Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, just muting the other meeting. Obviously, the DG and the officials will respond to most of their questions. It is the department's report to which, as the DG has said, the minister and I give oversight. I just wanted to start with Honourable Janki's questions. In the foreword, I had spoken about the reduction in the backlogs in the regional court and the district courts. That was at the end of the financial year, after effectively a year of COVID. And it basically was in the regional court from 53% to 48.87%, and in the district court, just trying to juggle. So it was decreased from 53% to 48.87%, which is a smallish reduction, and then quite a substantial reduction in the district courts from 48% to 14.14%. And the reason for it, I think, was we had, and I think some of the honourable members have asked, what did we do to reduce this? I mean, the one innovation we had was the establishment of a court optimization committee, which was effectively bringing together all the different stakeholders, representatives of the regional court presidents, the chief magistrates, the Department of Justice, Court Services, Legal Aid South Africa, the South African Police, Social Development. Trying to think if I've left anyone out, but it was all the main, correctional services, all the main role players. And it was basically a forum where the idea was to identify the problems that were causing blockages in the system and get them addressed. Unfortunately, it was earlier this year, the regional court presidents decided in their wisdom that they didn't want to attend these meetings anymore. And there was correspondence exchanged between them and myself, which the committee can have if it wants. Basically, they complained that they didn't like the meeting because they felt they were being told what to do and it was interfering with judicial independence. And then also they felt that because a member of the executive, in other words, myself as deputy minister, convened the meeting, that it was an interference as well with their judicial independence. In my response to them, I wanted examples of where in the minutes had been interference, where in the minutes they were being told what to do, because I couldn't find any evidence of that and didn't recall anything. You know, as far as having a member of the executive, well, they do often attend meetings convened by the department officials. Anyway, they were never able to properly respond to it, but they failed or refused to come back. Effectively, then there was no point continuing with the Court Optimization Committee meetings. I have raised the issue with the Chair of the Magistrates Commission, who has raised the issue at the head of courts, and there's then going to be further discussions about it. But that is unfortunately where that initiative ended. Currently, yes, the department is working on plans, but I mean, for me, the key issue is we've got to get the basics right. We've got to have courts that are not having, not able to sit because the CRT machines aren't working, or courts where sexual offences courts, particularly where evidence can't be led because the audiovisual equipment is not working. It's obviously not helped, obviously, by load shedding and the water outages that the DG referred to, but we've got to get our basics right to begin with. And then I think a key problem is, unfortunately, the regional courts. They have the backlog. There may be issues that need to be looked at as to whether too much is being referred by the NPA to the regional courts that could be heard in the district courts. But anyway, that's basically on that. On the issue then Honourable Janki raised on the debt collectors and the sheriff's board, look, they are not funded by public funds. They're funded, they're self-funded. And I think the sheriff's board or the South African board for sheriffs, they're both appointed by the minister. The minister, the sheriff's board, the deputy minister in the case of the Debt Collectors Council. I think the sheriff's board has been submitting annual reports. I think you got it last time. I'm not sure where this one is, but it is a new board. On the council for debt collectors, the 2018-19 report was submitted. They don't seem to have submitted the 19-21, which can be submitted, and we'll get it submitted to you. And then the 20-21, the last financial year, is still being audited, and the board will consider this in the upcoming meeting later this month. So that's that. On the issue, I just wanted to respond to one point that Honourable Horne raised, which was the audiovisual rollout. And yes, he's correct, but those provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act are actually out of date now. They were when there was no, I don't know what the correct terms are, Wi-Fi or things like that. You needed a fixed piece of equipment to do an audiovisual remand from the correctional center. Now you don't need it anymore. You can just have your laptop, make sure it's got internet connectivity, and away you go. So I'm just sort of raising that, and it's issues I've raised with departments. Do we need to put in fixed equipment in correctional services facilities when you can just do it with an iPad, with a laptop? probably an iPhone, probably a cell phone would probably be too little. So then the other point I raised, and Honourable Janki and I think Honourable Fawn raised the question of the magistrates and lower court bills. The magistrates court bill is basically ready for public consultation. It just needs a briefing to the minister. The lower court bill is almost ready. Yes, they have taken frustratingly longer than they should have, but then legislative development has had problems with officials, senior officials, getting COVID quite badly, and in the case of Ms. Ross, passing away. So I think, Chair, those were the main issues that I wanted to respond to. On Honourable Nevo Drushin's issue on the sign language interpretation, I think can we get, and rather than waiting to be, she's perfectly entitled to do what she's done, but it would be better to get the information up front relating to problems between the presiding officer and the sign language interpreter so as to be able to take it up with the regional court president or the chief magistrate concerned, depending on which court it's in. Chair, I think let me leave it like that for now. I'm going to have to go into this other event to give my speech that will remain in this meeting as well. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much. No, there are just two quick questions I forgot to ask. They will be directed to the DG and the team. From the report we got is that some officials are reluctant to participate in a beach committee. Can you share with us what would be the reasons for some officials to be reluctant to sit in the beach committee? Is that not a symptom of a bigger problem that might be happening in the department? And then the last one, your bonus strategy, it seems not to be linked to the organizational performance. For instance, when you were performing very badly in the year that you got 51%, you paid 58 million rand in bonuses to some individuals. Now you have paid 33 million to some individuals. Should the bonus system ultimately not to be linked to the performance of the whole unit, to the performance of the organization? Should people be getting performance bonuses when organizations are performing below average? For instance, in the case where you performed, where you got 51%, but some people got those bonuses, what were those bonuses based on? And if you can get a much more detailed response, from which units did these people get those bonuses? Because I would be surprised to have people from the master's office, for an example, getting bonuses. It will be based on what? Thank you very much. DJ?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I propose that in dealing with your questions, we will cluster them in this session. We will
maybe
take the first phase.
Maybe before you proceed, DJ, so that I'm not accused of being inconsistent. We always, when there are quite a number of questions, we give you 2 or 3 minutes to sort yourself who's going to be answering what. So can we convene at 10 past 12, 7 minutes past 12 now?
Yeah, okay, take that break, but we were ready, but I'm ready for that break.
Oh, you are ready? If you are ready.
No, maybe for the break, but...
Okay, can we come back at 10 past 10? Thank you very much. DJ, can you proceed?
immediately after finance will have done that. And we'll then move to the access to justice related questions, which is the major program of the Department of Court Services and Advocates COSANA, and the team of the senior managers. So Advocate Brent Kambule, who deals with the sexual related offenses matters here, they will deal with those questions. And then after we'll ask the chief master to handle all the master's related questions. There was a question, I think, on SIU and the state attorney. It shouldn't take the Solicitor General more than 2 minutes to briefly handle that. But also, I think the colleague dealing with facilities, when they deal with the corporate services matters as well, will answer some of those questions. The questions on legislative program have mainly been dealt with by the Deputy Minister, by the DDG, Kalei as well, who in 2 minutes covered some of the issues that who could have been left out. I think that's the approach we're going to take, Chair. I'll ask DDG, Konima Major, responsible for corporate services. I'll deal with some of the issues that directly have been raised to me once they dealt with those issues. Even your question, Chair, particularly right at the end, but they will still do some of them with regards to the bonuses as well, but I will make comments. Ms. Mamecha, I hand over to you to deal with the end of those questions.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member. Good afternoon, DG and Deputy Minister. The first question that related to the termination or the termination of employees. Chair, from the recent cultural and climate survey that we have conducted, it was noted that it has become a tendency to resign in various for various reasons, including, and this is not limited to what I'm going to be relating to, one being that employees get appointed in other departments for reasons that relate to promotion. And most of the time when they resign, some of them opt to cash their pension instead of just a transfer. And those are just for personal financial circumstances. And for other reasons, also which relates to COVID-19, we have realized that most of the people, the employees, were affected mentally and psychologically, and that has impacted on their well-being as employees, and some of them have opted to resign. The department has also further noted that where employees are subjected to disciplinary processes, before the disciplinary processes are completed, they then opt to resign. But Chair, we are very serious in terms of conducting exit interviews when it
DJ, there seems to be we can't hear you at all, ma'am.
In the process.
Sorry, we can't hear you at all. Committee Secretary, can you contact them?
Am I audible now, Okay. There was a question that relates to foreign workers, Chair, and I am taking it that you are basically referring to foreign language interpreters.
Sorry, ma'am.
Foreign language interpreters, Chair, are not appointed on a permanent basis, but on a casual basis at level 5. And this is a necessary service that we need in the court. Am I audible, Chair?
No, you lost us when you were talking about the exit interviews. After that, we could not hear you at all. If you can start there.
Am I audible now, Chair?
Yes, you are audible.
Okay. No, thank you, Chair. I think the last part, I was actually just referring to the fact that we are in the process of reviewing our staff retention policy to ensure that we can be able to retain our staff and become an employer of choice as a department. So the other question related to foreign workers, and I'm taking it, Chair, that it was actually relating to foreign language interpreters who are appointed as casual workers and not as permanent workers. They are appointed on salary level 5 against a set standard, Chair. And I was just saying these foreign language interpreters are a necessary service in the court. The other question related to a correlation of our vacancy rate that is below 10% at 8.2%. To the qualified audit opinion. I would leave it to finance, but just safe to say also, Chair, that as we have alluded to, that most of one of the issues, in fact, the most important issue that has led us to a qualified audit opinion related to contingent liability. All the issues that relate to IT, the CIO will respond to them. In terms of the COVID numbers of employees who succumbed to COVID, we have 1,079 cases that were recorded for COVID. And out of that number, only 118 employees succumbed to COVID. And that number includes the magistrates, Chair, that have also succumbed to COVID. The performance agreements that have not been signed by the SMS members, there are reasons in certain instances, and in other instances where there are no reasons, we have actually subjected those employees to disciplinary processes. We have given them letters to respond as to why they did not sign their performance agreements on time. One of the other reasons was the system downtime at the time when they were supposed to submit within a particular period. And during that period also, we have noticed that two employees resigned before they completed their performance agreement. So and one of the employees also was under suspension, but he has since been brought back to the department. But at that particular time, in the period under review, he had not signed his performance agreement.
How many have signed now? How many are standing now?
For the period under review, we had the 5 that were outstanding. I will just get the number of those that have not signed. 25, yes. I'm just being advised that it is 25 as in today. And those also have been written letters to respond. For the performance bonuses, Chair, the department has over the last performance year
before you go there, why are you not stopping the until this?
That is one of the issues that we have not actually sort of chair to stop their salaries. I will have to discuss with the DG and perhaps also just get advice from the DPSA if we can institute that. I'm not in a position to respond, Chair. May I proceed, Chair?
Yes.
In terms of the performance bonuses, as a department, we have over the last performance year reduced the performance bonus percentage to a minimum where in the previous period it was at high percentage. And Chair, I must just say, it is actually when the new DG came into the department, has actually seen that it is also a problem where we have not performed and we still have to pay our employees bonuses. However, performance assessment at level 3 to 12 is based on individual performance agreements as concluded between the employee, as concluded between the employee and the manager, and such are actually moderated by appointed moderation committees, and then a recommendation is made for the payment of such bonuses. But for SMF performance, it is linked to organizational performance. So the department is currently reviewing the PMDS policy and such aspects of organizational grant performance will also be included in the reviewed performance policy. Chair, I think I have covered most, or if not all. If there is any question that we have left out, I'm sure we can be able to respond to it in writing. Mr. Henton Gass will then assist in responding to the questions that related to IT in terms of the cyber attack as well. Henton?
Honorable members, am I audible?
Yes, you are.
I'm going to respond to all the IT related questions. Honorable member has mentioned that there are detailed questions forthcoming to the department, so I'm going to respond to those that are actually asked. We're looking forward to that engagement and to give detail around these questions. As far as the AVR rollout was reported as zero, in a COVID year as zero, we agree. Unfortunately, at the advent of COVID, as you would recall, there was also the lockdown of borders and the like. So our biggest issue at the time was with regards to sourcing the required systems due to the lockdown and the ports of entry having been closed. What also happened was, due to everyone being in lockdown and working from home, there was also a shortage of processors and IT-related hardware. But what we did as a department while we waited for that was to actually make sure that the existing AVR systems, 46 at the time, was actually working as it should, and that was used as part during the various stages of lockdown. We managed to implement those 18 after the reporting period, I think probably around May, June. But that's why it reflects as zero in this current annual report. As to the cyber attack on the department, the protection that we had in place and what we're doing going forward. So even before the ransomware attack, we had a comprehensive set of tools in place. We still do. We have firewalls in place, we have the antivirus, we have privileged access management tools in place, we use proxies for internet access, we also have tools related to security incidents and event monitoring.
The problem is that many of these were, like was reported, are in various states of disarray. Some of the licenses around it was not in place. And the department has started, even before the attack happened, procurement processes to fix that. And recent successes that they had with regard to that, as a result of the ransomware attack, we had to accelerate that, was obviously to get in place our security infrastructure, upgrade what we had, upgrade the antivirus, the firewalls and the proxies. We have further procurement processes underway to bring in new solutions that will help us to minimize the impact of any such event into the future. Things like continuity service, redesigning of our DR processes, including manual processes to that effect as well. Those processes are underway and we have a plan regarding that in place. As to whether we have staff available to monitor such things, I would want to deal with this in the context of the question that was asked about contractors as well. Our operating model currently as it stands is such that the majority of the work, the technical work, is outsourced to industry partners, and only a core team of departmental employees are employed for managing these contracts, making sure that they are actually direction and performance are happening as it should and the like. What happened is, due to there not having been a permanent structure, am I still audible, Chair?
Yes, you are.
Proceed, sir. A couple of years back, the department employed these bases. The thinking at the time was to do that, they could quickly turn around the IT
salary levels and the like. These contracts have then been.
I think he was saying that
over the last couple of years. But
I think he must switch off your video again with his law.
So what we've extended this contract for a while, but at the end of September this year,
we can't hear you. Committee secretary, can you
extend
that in the contact? I can't hear
better now, Chair?
Yes.
So as part of the restructuring, the department has approved an interim structure for IT environment, and we have advertised all those positions. We have appointed some, and we're expecting to appoint in the next couple of weeks some more. As far as the youth is concerned, it's a big priority for the department, but obviously it depends on how the efforts go and the appointments go. On the issue of the cybersecurity attack and mitigation plan going forward, like I was saying, there is a plan to answer firstly our security posture, but also to make sure that an attack of this nature doesn't happen, but if it do, that the impact is minimized. So what we are doing at the moment is we are replacing all the outdated hardware, renewing all the licenses that have been expired. And this includes the likes of increased new intrusion prevention systems, threat management, and security and incident event monitoring tool sets. The plan includes upgrading all the dilapidated hardware in both the data center. This includes the servers and storage at the various ports. This includes the site servers, the switches, and in the next financial year, I'll probably replace all the CRT equipment as well, and end-user devices, the laptops, the scanners, and the desktops as well. All of these are various stages of procurement to be finalized in the 2021-2022 financial year. The question about why the department are using contractors, I think I have answered that. It's mostly around our operating model, and unless it's other contractors that I'm not sure. The information on social media that these attackers have been planned, as a department, we were not aware of it. But this is mostly because we don't have the necessary tools. And in hindsight, as part of improving our security posture, we are definitely looking at upgrading, implementing a security operating center in consultation with other state agencies, the likes of CITA, CSIR, we have engagements with them, that will allow us to monitor not just the social media, but also any indication of things directed at the department's reputation, and will also allow us to be more protective in terms of the responses. On the status of PADX, what is the current status of the PADX system and the implementation of the maintenance? We have concluded the maintenance contract on PADX earlier this year. So all of the PADXs currently deployed are under maintenance. However, there are two 32 that need to be replaced. We have kicked off a project to replace them as part of that maintenance contract. Due to the restructuring and the expiry of the IT contractors' contracts, that process was put on hold. Ransomware also didn't help. It came to a halt. But we've kickstarted that in October again, and we are anticipating that in the next month we will replace about 68 of these PADXs. The plan is to have all of them implemented by the end of the financial year. CRT, SOS, and ADR is a little bit more difficult. There is no contract currently in place, that is correct. Maintenance contract in place, but we are working on it and expect to have this concluded in the next week or so. The issue about repairs not having been done since September, I'm not so sure where this comes from, because as far as my knowledge goes, we had an interim process in place up until the end of September. It's only from October. I'm not saying it's better. I'm just trying to correct the facts. Let's say from October, we didn't have a contract in place, and we're looking at it at a time and material basis. But we've also kickstarted an emergency process to get in place the contract, which I'm saying is probably in the next week or so it should be concluded, barring any other issues that comes up. If the recorder is full, has it to be switched off? That is correct. So maybe I should explain a little bit more. I think it also deals with the security issue. So in terms of the CRT architecture, at any point in time, there are three copies of the record in the system. There's one on the recorder, there's one on the site server, and there's one on the central storage. So in the normal course of business, the recorder will sync a copy to the site server, and from there, we go to the normal storage. Now, where we are with all the dilapidated infrastructure, there are some ports, not all of them, where the site servers are obviously down. The ransomware has also impacted on some of the site servers. And as a result, the recorders are forced to keep the recordings on it. So one of the things that we're doing now, like I explained earlier, is that we are replacing those site servers as part of the emergency procurement that we're busy with. But there's also mobile recorders that are able to roam across all of these. Some of the ports are also looking at alternative means to actually save the recordings by writing them to CD. I know it's a tedious process, but these are all the mechanisms in place. But ideally, we would want to have the support and maintenance contract sorted out as a priority so that we can actually configure the recorders to be able to sync the recordings back to where it should be without any human intervention. That should be in place in the next week or two, hopefully. I think that's all the questions related to IT check.
Thank you.
Good day, Chair and the Honorable Committee Members.
I would want to start with the question regarding, and Chair, if you may allow me, I'll try to combine some of the questions that are related. There was a question that was asking why spend 95% and only achieve, to support the achievement of 66%. I'll want to put it this way. There was initially a slide that was trying, that we presented, that was trying to show of the 20 billion expenditure we had last year, how much of it is not directly related to the indicators, where we saw that there was expenditure of about 1.2 billion relating to accommodation, provision of accommodation, 900 million almost for security services, 3 billion relating to all the transfers that were made to other entities, and so on and so forth. And that constituted about 84% of our total expenditure. That is the first part that I want to provide as a response. But again, when you look at some of the indicators that we saw, some of them are personnel driven, and when you look at our personnel expenditure, we spend about 93% of our total compensation of employees' budget, and a big share of it is directed towards supporting the indicators, which some of them could not achieve, and that could be attributed to vacancies that we probably had in the department. When you look at our performance this year versus the previous financial performance, financial year's performance, indeed, Chair, the department regressed in terms of its spending. And the regression, you will see it under goods and services mostly. Yes, under compensation of employees and magistrate salaries, there is regression, and I can be able to also, let me start with compensation of employees and magistrate salaries. The regression will be attributed to natural attrition, one that we suffered this last year due to many of our colleagues losing their lives as a result of COVID. There was a slide that was in the annual report. I remember it was Member Janji, where he was saying about 420, people resigned from the department. That was another contributor. But another biggest contributor was that last year we received a lot of money from National, a lot of money. We received additional funding from National Treasury for compensation of employees to fund NPA for appointment of prosecutors, and so on and so forth. And though there was a filling of vacancies, but most of the vacancies that got that were filled from the NPA side, you'll see that most of the positions were filled towards the latter part of the financial year. And the month in which we did not have a position filled contributed in the underspending that we had. When you look at compensation of employees last year, the underspending was just under 300 million, 260 million, but in the year under review, we incurred an underspending of about 330 million, and part of it is attributed to that. But a huge regression in terms of our performance, spending-wise, was on goods and services, because when you compare the underspending in 2019-20 versus 2020-21, you can see that the underspending in 2019-20, it was about 41 million, but when you look at the year under review, we incurred about 310 million worth of underspending. And part of it is attributed to the underperformance in the implementation of the IGF-CGF project. I remember, Chair, you were making an example to say when you look at computer services, we have underspent. And a lot of services supporting the IJS, the JS system, as well as the modernization, are sitting under that particular spending item. Also, we used to incur a lot of expenditure as a result of psychiatric observation. And last year, for psychiatric observation, I think we only processed one payment of about 83 million versus 120 million that we normally spend in many years. And when you look at those expenditure, though they support the court system, but they don't directly link to the indicators that you see reflected in our GDP. There was a question relating to an increase in fines and sale of goods and services. Let me start with the fines. Last year it was a COVID year, and as part of the COVID regulations, there were penalties or fines imposed for all the people that will transgress the COVID regulations. I think it was about 1,500, and we had a lot of those, you know, fines that were. The cost that we recover for in our court when the attorneys use our photo proper machines. So that was the most contributor in terms of the increased collection of revenue on those particular items. Chair, there was a question pertaining to the reluctance of officials participating in bid processes. And when you look at the procurement process, by its nature, it's a very risky process. I think also the Public Audit Act also contributed, because when you read that act, it does put accountability to personal accountability to all those officials who would have, you know, contributed in the occurrence of irregular expenditure. So there has been reluctance indeed from most of the officials in the department. But from this year, we have seen an improvement, and the DG has made it compulsory and mandatory that all senior managers must participate in these committees, and we have since then seen an improvement in terms of participation of colleagues, you know, in these bid committees. And it is still a journey that we are working on, but there are improvements that we are seeing in this regard. A non-compliance with local content. It was an oversight, and most of these cases occurred in our region. And oversight was that many of our colleagues did not see the circular issued by DCI, but that has since been resolved, Chair. We did circulate the circular, but our colleagues will be going to training already next week to DCI to be trained also on how to apply, you know, these requirements of local content. But since then, we have not had serious issues around PPP procurement. With regards to the quotations that were above the published treasury prices, there has been a forensic audit in this regard, and we await a report in terms of that process, because we did pick that one up, and these matters were referred to internal audit. I mean, not internal audit, forensic audit for identification, and I know that forensic audit was in its advanced stage to deal with this. Now, with regard to a condonment, there was one case of 298 million that we spoke of, the 238 million that we spoke of, that we referred to National Treasury for condonment. We have run all our processes, and we even referred the matter to labor relations for consequence management. But what transpired in that chair was that officials who were for the provision of the services. That's how this is regulated. COSANA, who chairs DEFCON, through which the CARA requests are processed, is going to be able to be responding to that. And if there's any gaps to fill from our side, we'll definitely fill them. Chair, I do want to make this comment in terms of our audit, particularly the contingent liability qualification. In 2019-20, the basis for the qualification in respect of the contingent liability register busy focusing on addressing issues of completeness, and we have in the blind spot that we are now overstating the opening balances. And I think it is important that we do share that feedback. Even AG did commend the department for the work that it had put in terms of trying to resolve this qualification, but we are hopeful that with all the efforts that we are putting in the current financial year, definitely this qualification will potentially what we are currently sitting with now in terms of money being owed by many of the departments that we have provided service to, we are sitting at just over 1.6 billion. Actually, I must say that we are having departments that are indeed paying us. And this is a result of the engagement that we started last year with many of the other departments that were biggest departments, Department of Health, SAPS, Education. So with those departments, we created a debt management committee, and these committees are twofold. There's a steering committee in which all the CFOs of the client departments are participating in, and another committee, which is a task team that is looking that is meeting on a monthly basis to deal with issues that are hindering collection. And with SAPS, collection has since improved. They are paying us on a monthly basis. Department of Health, we're engaged with the Department of Health in Eastern Cape, and their treasurer is trying to help them to pay us, and Department of Health in Gauteng is also on board, as well as the Department of Education. But even in this month, we are rolling out these committees to all the other departments that are owing us. But definitely, Chair and the Honorable Committee members and assistance from your side will also be greatly appreciated to ensure that we are able to improve our collection capability. With regards to the recovery of our money from the company that was not a VAT vendor, the matter, we have not been able to recover our money, but the matter has since been referred to our state attorneys, and they are handling it to ensure that we eventually get our money. We will be trying to get an update from the state attorney and the chair with the commission. Once we have gotten that update from the state attorney, we will also provide an update to the committee if the committee will be comfortable with that arrangement. Oh, yes. With regards to the irregular expenditure of 800 million, our investigation as a department is in its advanced stage. Ms. Freya in the presentation did indicate that about 500 million of that will be concluding a report for this year's consideration, so that this matter is closed. But what actually transpired to check was that some of the service providers had submitted fraudulent COIDA certificates and UIF certificates. And as part of our investigation, we had to engage the Department of Labor to find out if these certificates were indeed submitted by them, were issued by them. In our first engagement with the Department of Labor, Department of Labor did confirm that these are their certificates, but they were not too certain if they were issued by dedicated officials. Now, we then requested the Department of Labor to then conduct an investigation, their own internal investigation, so that we can find conclusion on this. They then came back later to the department to say they have conducted an investigation, and they are confirming that these certificates were not issued by them. But another challenge that we also faced as a department was that some of the service providers had already referred these matters to the office for their investigation, which then suggested the chair. Also, the service providers were victims of whoever, you know, fraudulently circulated this certificate. But we have then conducted our investigation, but also there were also inefficiencies in the manner in which the process was managed internally in the department, and we've conducted this investigation to identify as to where the inefficiencies would have occurred, so that when the DG considers our report, it's a report that provides all perspectives, so that at least eventually we can find conclusions on this matter. So we are looking at concluding this process at this month.
Thank you.
On that one. Oh yes. Okay. Chair, with regards to the security of our vote, last year when I started to act, this was one area that I also identified as one area that was risky. And what we then did, the first measure that we did was to change the vote law, which we did. Then the second step that we undertook was to put cameras inside the vault, which look at the vault 360 degrees, but also outside the vault. And we also put in a physical guard in the corridor where the vault is, as to ensure that security of the vault is indeed strengthened, and that still remains in place. So those were the measures that we put in place to make sure that at least the security of bid documents is enhanced, and we continue to find other ways of strengthening the security of the bid documentation within the department. The other measure we put in place to ensure that the security of our bid documents is strengthened was that we had a search drive where in all the bid documents relating to the contracts we have in place will be scanned and be saved in the search drive. But we don't know now what is the extent of the impact of the malware on those documents. And it's a request that we're still gonna look at and see what's the impact on our documents that we have on our share transaction. With regards to contract management, we were operating without a dedicated DD manning that function, and this year a DD was appointed to specifically focus on our contract management processes within the department. But Chair, as another measure, we did also identify that there was a gap between the bid office and the contract management office. There was no interface, because we'll find that the bid office is busy and consumed with projects that are in the procurement plan, but which are not also addressing projects that are about to expire as per our contract register. Now, we have put in place a process wherein there must be an interface, a continuous interface between our bid office and the contract management office, so that whenever the contract management office issues notice of contracts that are about to expire in a year, that information is also forwarded to the bid office, so that the bid office can then begin to proactively engage with those project managers for initiation of procurement processes. We have just recently started this, and we are hopeful that this will indeed reduce instances where contracts their life cycle without a new service provider appointed to ensure that the services that are provided by the contract that is about to expire are indeed in place. I would want to pause here, Chair. I hope I've covered all the questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members, and Deputy Minister is still there. I will deal with questions. I've calculated about 8 of them. But let me start with one comment on the question by Honorable Janji. Firstly, Chair, among the matters we've delivered on, where we were able to achieve last year in the annual report, are the terms of reference for the review and transformation of the civil justice system and the criminal justice system. Now, I'm relating this question to the issue of the Council for Debt Collectors, as well as the Southern Port for Sheriffs. These two bodies are mainly involved with what is basically your civil justice system. And they are operating under law, old principles and law. The Sheriff's Act was in 1980. And therefore, even in terms of the annual report, although they submit the annual report, there's no obligation for the tabling as such with annual report. The debt council, the council for debt collectors, they've got a very funny provision which simply say that they must get an accountant to issue financial statements in terms of the financial year involved without even taking the matter any further. And we believe because both of these organizations, they run priority funds, which priority funds are intended to protect public interest, where the rights of people are infringed. It will be important that at least the Minister and Cabinet and South Africans get to know what happened in terms of matters that are dealt by these bodies. And I think it will be dealt with as part of that broad review process. Terms of reference to the review of the criminal justice system have been approved, as including the performance and that the minister assigned those functions to the Southern Law Reform Commission to come to those processes. And I think they are lined up they've been included in the Law Reform Commission's work, and I think there will be talks around that. And I think all those shortfalls or shortcomings of the old legislation will be dealt with as part of the process. Coming to that, Chair, let me deal with the Honorable Swart also asked a matter relating to the forfeiture orders issued by the SIU. And I think my colleague Ms. Fide will deal with it. But basically, there's a process underway where there's a harmonization between the SIU and NPA around the forfeiture unit processes. SIU, the special tribunal, is allowed by law to grant those orders, and they grant them as part of the alternative dispute resolution process, separate from the court process. As we know, that the special tribunal has been basically enacted to fast track all those processes so that they don't get delayed in the court, etc. I can just say that they've submitted draft amendments to bills to the department, which is going to seek to harmonize those processes, and I think that will basically address whatever juncture which exists between the SIU and the NPA as a forfeiture unit. And this will hopefully will give the SIU full powers to be able to recover funds where they've basically where they've investigated matters arising from the maladministration by the SIU. And then let me also then come to the issue of the CARA question, which has been raised by Mr. Swart. Yes, CARA gets allocated by cabinet, and from 2016, I've been fortunately involved with the processing of the cabinet memorandum and submission to cabinet, so that it can approve and consider whatever need to be considered. CARA only pays in respect of two aspects. One, for the intervention of interventions necessary to combat organized crime, and two, to support organizations that support victims of crime. So those are the only two instances: intervention and organization, not government, organizations that support victims of crime. And those and cabinet goes very strictly around those measures, because it has happened that over the years some of the departments have made bids for CARA to augment their shortfalls on the baseline allocation by the child treasurer. And I think there have been a clear dedicated approach to ensure that that does not happen. That's why you will always see that cabinet is very cautious to grant that money willy-nilly, because people come, they make submission and they get refused. I can tell you in 2017, cabinet only approved two instances. One, they approved 50 million for the NPA for the Suzera care centers, because those cities are very essential in terms of protecting the rights of victims and survivors. And two, they 50 million to SSA to deal with aspects of cybercrime. In terms of, and that was intended to address issues of the cyber bill, which was basically in process, as well as the cyber police. I can say there's a very effective or very strong CARA management position. What is CARU? CARU is CARA unit in the Department of Justice under the finance of the CFO. After cabinet has approved those allocations, monies are not in the department. They're kept under CARU until departments submit plans which have been debated and have been basically intended to meet what comes approved. It's then that money gets allocated to those departments, and that gets allocated through a system which ensures that they only get what they're going to need. Otherwise, if you give money to a department, what's going to happen is that that money may be used for any other purposes, and it may be difficult for justice to account for it in terms of its accounting responsibility. That's why we continue to get in audit under CARA, because of the strict governance system in place. I think cabinet have also assisted in also given directly from time to time to improve those governance arrangements, etc. So SSA has not yet claimed the money for cybercrime. It still lies with us, and I think it's a matter which gets dealt with at the digital cluster, because what we do on a quarterly basis, we get to debate the digital where we give reports on the CARA, and those departments which have asked for money and they're not able to spend, they get questions. Why have they asked money? So it's because of the provision cabinet they pulled that. If it does allocate a budget and there's no spending on it, we can come back to cabinet to recommend that it be diverted to other areas of need, etc. And there's a process in terms of which the department has given a notice that you have not received this money, it will not be diverted, and then we go to cabinet. And it's only after we've taken that step that they start coming, rushing to spend, because cabinet is going to crucify them for not having spent their budget, etc. Mr. Honneth asked questions around the issue of the case backlog, etc. Let me indicate, we did say, when it came to the framework to the portfolio committee, we said the framework document is a long-term or it's a medium to long-term strategy to deal with backlogs, because we're mindful that these backlogs which get increased by COVID are going to stay with us for long. The direction that minister published under the data management regulation are short-term measures. So it's not that there's nothing happening. So the cost optimization process which the deputy minister alluded to, which was part of the directions that have been enacted, and part of the other measures is to the prioritization, the priority role, which have become part of what have been implemented by the stakeholders. And I think there was clear guidance and that directions were aimed to keep the courts open even during the hard lockdown, so that all cases that involve gender-based violence, all cases involve corruptions, whatever, they ought to continue in terms of their exchange. So the framework was intended to take over the process once we are no longer able to come with directions, etc. And that case backlog framework is dependent on the consultation stakeholders. It's a framework which is not only justice focused. It must draw in the NPA, it must talk to the judiciary, it must talk to the legal aid, it must talk to the legal practitioners, whatever. And that's why the second time we could not balance the consultation in the previous financial year. The meeting with the heads of court, Honorable Chair and members, only managed to take place on the 29th of October, 3 days before the election. And the agenda was so loaded that it was not all matters were dealt with. It only took those matters that were supposed to deal with that on agency basis. The heads of courts have agreed with the minister that they will prioritize a day in January to deal with the outstanding matters. The framework documents part of those matters. They must commit to it. They manage the court. They hear science. They've got hours in terms of the Chief Justice has come in the non-substance for the court. And then the framework must talk about how the court must deal with judges and magistrates who are not able to deal with the hours as part of this arrangement. That's why I'm saying that it's a more complex. We facilitate the framework, but it requires the involvement of the stakeholders. And I think it's a process the minister is leading, and I think we'll then be able to deal with it moving forward, etc. Whilst we're still there, let me also deal with the issue of the court arbitration model, because it's also linked to the court efficiency and court productivity. That program, that process is with cabinet, but I've been fortunate to have been involved in the process that sought to develop a policy framework to respond to what the judiciary submitted to cabinet as their proposed model. And Chair, by the time the minister comes there, he's going to bring to this committee what are the proposed models which have been placed for cabinet. Some of the models are not workable under the current constitution. There are quite a lot of engagement between the executives and the judiciary to refine themselves. And I don't think the minister must bring to the parliament a half-baked product and say that this is what we cannot find each other. And there have been those points of engagement around those models. And I think the meeting on the 29th has also been allowed to arrange for possibility for them to engage on what are the proposed models of the executive, so that they can then some meeting of minds between the executive and the judiciary, and which can then fit into a legislative process, which can then come to parliament itself. And I'm sure that at some point the minister will be able to share with the committee where that process is. But I can simply assure the honourable member that a lot of work has unfolded in this space. A lot of research has unfolded. A comparative and benchmarking exercise have taken place. The DG have put in place a task team led by certain members of EXCO to assist in terms of harnessing that process. And the product is there. And I think what now remains is for cabinet to engage the judiciary on the proposed response to what they've put on the table, so that this process can unfold, and I think parliament and all the members of the public can get that there to understand where the process is around this space, etc. Then moving from there, there was a question by which minister, deputy minister responded to partly around the issue of the, and my colleague, Ms. Mamish, around the issue of the interpreter. Let me start first with the foreign language interpreters, because I've also linked with the sign language interpretation. Firstly, I think following what the president announced, the process underway to get the sign language as an official language in the constitution, so that all government departments can basically be compelled to put programs in place to ensure that there's effective implementation of that policy. That's the first point. The second point is that foreign language interpreters, before the COVID-19, and I think some of the positive outcomes of the closure of the borders and the limitation of the travel to the provinces, is that it stopped the few foreign language interpreters from traveling from one province to another, probably the very same languages, at huge cost. Although you will see that on the annual report, there are very few numbers and they get very paid very less in terms of level 3 to 5. They used to augment their salaries through SNT's harvest. So each and every interpreter will choose to go to the various court in the land to go and interpret in the foreign languages so that they can then train SNT overnight accommodation, whatever, to make good for those level 3 to 5, whatever arrangement. What we have done, put into space, because they cannot travel outside the provinces, we've created a database framework. And that database framework articulates all the foreign language all the non-national languages which are spoken predominantly in different parts of the country. And then we then put a database of people around those courts, around those districts. So what happened then, we were developing a kind of a booking system so that the prosecutor, when there is a docket, they should then be able to book an interpretation Friday ahead of time, before the date of time, so that there can then be a process to get that interpreter booked up for those stuff. And then we will pay it on hourly basis. And I think it's 935 or so rents paid per hour. We no longer paid by level. And I think this is one of the programs through which we hope to enhance those services. But also, we invited even South Africans, because we believe that people have been through DERCO, and I'm sure that DG has spent some time in that department, can encourage people who have been exposed to those other languages of other countries so that they can basically enlist the database. Then we can then be able to rely on South Africans who have studied the French and the Swahili and then the Mandarin languages without the need to get those people from outside, so that we can basically have a more effective and also beef up the job creation from the South African perspective. Then moving to the next one, chapter, there was the question. I'm just my colleague colleagues from infrastructure will augment, but I must just indicate one point around the bank cost. And the challenge is the government policy. Government is self-insured, does not have insurance. So when Supreme Court bends down, or when Brooklyn bends down, they must go and allocate that budget from the vote allocation voted into by parliament. There's no money put aside to insure, and it's surprising because government has got a well-structured unemployment insurance fund. And I think any process to establish asset insurance fund will basically be very welcome, because government can then insure its own precious assets. The Mpumalanga High Court is an engine pump. We've spent $1 billion to build, and we've spent hundreds of millions to put infrastructure, IT and everything, etc. If it bends down, all that investment goes to ashes. It can only be recouped through a vote allocation. We must go and get new money to rebuild that cost. That's the reason why it costs such a long time, because people go around to sample for budget. Problem number two, they still struggle to get the service providers to come and do the work, because the initial person to build the cost are no longer there. The equipment is bent, lost, whatever. You don't know what the plan in terms of your IT fireplace arrangement, whatever in the building, all those complicated aspects around the court, etc. But obviously, that's one of the biggest challenges. In terms of policy, if a court bends down because of some negligence on the part of the user, there's a core payment between us and public works. If it bends down because it was a natural disaster, public works must pay for that building, etc. And we must wait for them to allocate. We can't take money and allocate for it, because it will be regular if we do that. We spend money for this year, to build more courts to resuscitate a banned court. And those are kind of complexities which must be dealt with in terms of the policies, and I think create options for Kiama to be revised to address those challenges. Now that we have at one point almost 4 courts that have been down, I think it calls more for more policy engagement around this, and DPWI starts to engage in the space. And I think the engagement with DPWI is basically on policy aspects as well as on operational aspects. But one of the aspects which has led to huge under expenditure and where we stayed last year is the whole issue of the contract management. that we can, at any given time, when there's any glitch in terms of plumbing system, in terms of a roofing, a leaking roof, whatever, we can basically get into the term contact and get people appointed from the database to come and do that. That will improve the turnaround time, to improve the spending patterns, whatever. We have missed this target in the previous financial year. And what we did, honorable chair member, we've not done that target. We brought forward this year, and we have been engaging with PWI, and I think I can say that we are already on the agitation stage of that term contract, so that it can improve the speed within which we repair all the damage. Currently, if anything happens in a court, the court manager ought to look around the service providers who are there around the 100,000, or to check and get the quotations, evaluate, etc. And the challenge that in the small towns and small suburbs, you will never get those people, etc. They always have to come out of the small town at huge cost to come and pay for those aspects, etc. There was a question on the yes, and I think Honorable will basically be pleased around the measures on the magistrate. Part of the under-expenditure of the magistrate, and which is the same scenario with the judge, is that the judicial establishment has not been rationalized in both levels of the high. And we could not have rationalized the judicial establishment before we rationalized the areas of jurisdiction, making sure that courts have accurate jurisdiction around the areas over which people reside, etc. That process in the Master Court has been finalized. The last four provinces will be coming into effect from the 1st of January. So from the 1st of January, all the magisterial districts in this country would have been aligned to the local municipalities boundary, so that all the old pre-1994 demarcations will be the thing of the past. That was the first part. The second part, that once we have done that, you must then say what numbers of judges and magistrates you need to perform functions in the new configured court. The minister have appointed a committee led by Justice Musanege in terms of the High Court. The Magistrates Commission have appointed a committee to give the same exercise in terms of the Magistrates Court, and which was a very positive outcome from the Magistrates Commission. We could not have asked the very same process done by the JSC, because the JSC meets only twice a year. And judges and practitioners, whatever, in our council, if you ask them to do any work, you will never get anything from them because their plates are loaded. But the Masters Commission, they have agreed to put a team together to do that transition for the magistrate establishment. Once we have done that check, we'll then be able to put the number of magistrates where they are required. I can even pause to say that from the 1st of October this year, 168 new magistrates were appointed, and they started to work after the commission had taken a tedious process to interview those persons. It has made a dent in terms of underspending, but not a huge dent that we would like to see. Secondly, the Magistrates Commission recommended the minister that they upgrade certain levels of magistrates who are responsible for overseeing the work of other courts. Because what has been happening is that the Magistrates Commission have only been so overburdened with appointment processes toward the JSC that they have not have had time to look into issue of service delivery. Honorable Chair, you have raised this point at the JSC and say the JSC requires that Parliament must be given a report, an annual report on its functioning, so that other than the appointment of judges, they can make comments on the effectiveness of the judicial system. And we rely on the JSC and the Magistrates Commission because they come from an independent angle, and they will also be able to advise the department and the OCJ in terms of steps to be taken. So we hope that those costs are going to help basically minimize the under expenditure, and hope that the process will change over some time. So, Chair, those are the methods that we've basically been able to deal with. And I think the last point relates to what has been raised around the incomplete, inaccurate information. I must, and that pertains, it's not generic, I must just admit that. We were not found one thing in terms of everything which is information based. We found one thing in terms of the NRSO in particular, because of the and certain aspects around the court backlogs, etc. Some of the other information has been there. And I think part of the reason why we found one thing around those aspects is because of the completeness of the information that was submitted. Once the OAG went to the court, they found that the information has been collected, and when they verified information with a source document, they found some discrepancies, and in certain instances, information has not been complete. And the reason for that, Chair, has been that we have, because of capacity challenges, we have not had enough supervisory functions at court level to sign off on the information that's been collected before it gets captured into a system, our NOC system, etc. And this is the biggest challenge. And I think the part of what the DG process of strengthening the region is to ensure that regional offices are there to validate and quality assure information collected court level. So by the time it gets verified by AG, whatever, it has passed that part. And I think it's once we are dealing with this part of moving forward and this part of the current strategy, and we hope that will be better over time. Chair, I've got a team of colleagues who support me, senior managers from court services, and should I have left any other aspect to which ought to have been attended to, I'm sure they'll be allowed to.
No, you have not. The DG has been rounded up.
What I'm trying to do is to check the some colleagues who are not sitting here. We have advocates of disability colleagues and gender-based violence crisis. So we request that she take the floor. I think she's online to answer those. In not more than 5 minutes.
Can it be less?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, DG. The first question that we received is from the Honorable Swart, that talks to the 100 Days Rapid Result Initiative that the department introduced during the COVID financial year. It is an initiative that was introduced also to respond to one of the indicators of the national strategic plan for GBVF. I would like just to say that we piloted it in 10 courts. Due to the COVID-19 lockdown restrictions, and the purpose for the program is to remove the waste from the service chain, as well as to improve then the turnaround time in the finalization of the domestic violence matters, and also to eliminate the backlog cases in domestic violence applications for protection orders. So the success rate of this of this project, it was 98% percentage of the reduction of the elimination, rather the elimination of the backlog cases in the domestic violence applications for protection orders. So now we are in a process of rolling it out to all courts, and we have started to do so. And I would only just say that because we are collecting statistics so as to ensure that then all the courts are actually following the principle. And in June, we had the success rate of 76%, but only now focusing on the new applications for protection orders so as to ensure that then we speed them up and they are finalized within 90 days. The second question then, it is on the issue of disability. So what I can say here is that we have a serious problem first with the issue. I'm going to focus first on the sign language interpretation services. As we know that the sign language is not yet recognized as a universal language, and for that, it is because of the fact that not everybody understands it. There is no common understanding of the dialects to sign language, and also we have the court users that are coming from the disadvantaged and impoverished communities who come to court not understanding it. So what we have done then as the department is to develop then the national policy framework on reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities, and one of the requirements for the courts then is to keep a directory of sign language services with the assistance, of course, of the prominent South African sign language, that is the SASL, and to ensure that then there is access to justice. So basically that is what we have done, and it is also a policy that is improving the language accessibility, physical accessibility, as well as the information accessibility to our court. So the next question that she asked was, have we aligned the 75 courts to this policy? I would like just to say that this is an indicator for this financial year. It's not for the time under review. And as a department, we are in a process then of implementing it, and we develop in quarter one of this financial year the minimum standards for the national policy framework so as to ensure that then it complies with all these areas of accessibility that we have actually identified. So in a nutshell, then those are the two responses that I can give. Thank you. In 3 minutes, thank you.
Thank you very much. The issue of the gender mainstreaming, the consultant that was appointed, does it fall under you? Where you spend just over $1 million for a consultant to do gender mainstreaming?
Is that yours? What is that gender mainstreaming? Can you ask the GP? I don't know what happened to Praise. She got cut.
Yeah, no, Chair. I just say that not we are trying to look in for gender. Chair, I was just indicating that the consultant.
We can't hear you, advocate.
Okay, nothing, Charm. I was just indicating that this is trying to get the senior manager responsible for the gender unit in the department. It's not under court services, that aspect. And I think this will come back to it if we've been able to locate them. I can just indicate one point under the responses that the Malmesbury Band Court, the tender documents have been finalized, and I think the tender will be going out before the December holidays. And that's what my colleague, Ms. Kajiaga, have just confirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, DG. Good afternoon, Honorable Chair. I believe the Deputy Minister might be back. Afternoon, Honorable Deputy Minister, Honorable Members, the DG, the Chair of the Risk Committee, colleagues. I'm just going to answer to three questions that were directed to the Master's Branch. The first question coming from Honorable Swart regarding the details as to the SIU recommendations on the investigations that they have conducted within the master's branch. So far, we have received 11 recommendations, and of the 11, one was long received during about the early days after the proclamation. I think it was in February or March of last year. It was a suspension of an official because the SIU had thought it was going to hamper on the activities. But I think the suspension did not happen and they were not hampered. They have been engaging with us relating to the other matters. Of the remaining 10, there were 3 matters that related to a chief director, and the disciplinary process has started on the 10th of this month, and it's been postponed for further and commencement for about 5 days, the 31st of January to the 4th of February of next year. The other remaining 8 matters, one official has since resigned after the matter on which the SIU had referred to us and a matter that the department has found had suspended this official, and the official, before she could be charged, has since resigned. The remaining 6 are those that had followed the unlawful instruction, and on the advice of our counsel, who is dealing with the main matter of the chief director, we are rather taking a cautious approach with the HR to say we need these other 6 as witnesses in a matter. Therefore, we cannot commence with their matter at this stage. But as soon as they are done there, we would then commence with them so that they do not turn hostile to the department. The second question from Honorable Swart was also the question where there are mandamus applications that may be sought where officials would have either delayed or did not issue the necessary appointment letters. We are aware of those applications, and of importance, I think it was the need to understand what would have caused that there be this lapse, and what corrective action are we taking to attend to this. So what we have basically done is that we noted that in every matter which is litigated against the master's branch, we have a record and a database. And as we refer the matter with the instruction whether we are abiding or opposing or opting for settlement, we keep the record. We pass the matter to the law enforcement unit within the department with a further instruction that says that a determination of liability has to be done. It will be important going forward that we improve on the actual outcomes of those liabilities. Should it be attributed to official who had just failed or was just negligent or just refusing to attend to his or her work, that we take corrective action. But we had also understood that part of the question could have been, of the challenge could have been during the hard lockdowns when we were to operate in line with the DPSA directive of about 50 or less or 70% when people were rotating. That could have been a factor that causes, because files were allocated per numbers to various officials in the bigger office, to change and let somebody sit in and take over on behalf of the other could have caused the problem. But that is not necessarily debarring us from conducting the assessment of whether the official could and should have done his work in time. And once we get that report from law enforcement and it recommends that we take correct action, we will definitely forward it to our labor unit to do that. The last question came from Honorable Breitenbach on the details as to how we will be addressing the backlog which had arisen as a result of the ransomware, as a result of COVID as a result of even the load shedding. In the branch, we have assessed the number of backlog matters and have embarked since about from the 8th of November, Monday this week or Tuesday this week, have embarked on extra hours. And we have not just given a blanket extra hours to attend to the backlog, but we are monitoring it and we have taken an approach that says, based on the number of the backlog per office, we have allocated a 2 to 6 weeks plan to address that. That would be all from the master. I hope that covered it.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee member. I'm here to respond to the question raised with regard to community rehabilitation. The question was community rehabilitation is no longer in the APP. Has it been implemented? If it has not been implemented, when will it be implemented? I would like to indicate that, yes, there is progress in terms of its implementation. However, the reason why it's out of the APP is because the regulations that speak to the implementation of community rehabilitation were not yet finalized. What has happened up to now is there has been consultation with different communities which have indicated desires of the types of projects that we want to see. And two sets of regulations have been published for public comments. And the comments which were received have been evaluated. There was even consultation with different structures that are interested in the program. The comments that have been evaluated have now been included in a new version of draft regulations. And the draft regulations are now en route to the minister for approval. And once the regulations are approved, then the work in terms of the implementation of the already conceptualized projects will be done and will then continue to further engage the other communities that also have to be rehabilitated with regard to the TRC recommendation. That will be my response. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hope you can hear me. Thank you very much, members of the committee, the DM, APG, and colleagues on the platform. I think the question that has been asked of me primarily is from Mr. Honorable Member Swart in relation to the investigation by the SIU. I must point out at the outset, Chairperson, that I think in the last sitting, in relation to this particular issue, it was indicated that the Portfolio Committee would like to hear from the Office of the Solicitor General, the NPA, as well as the SIU under one sitting, so that we can actually deal with all the matters that have been snagged. But just for the purposes of answering this question, I must indicate that there were reports that in fact preceded my appointment and in session led to the impact that on the Office of State Attorney in Johannesburg. In relation to those matters, both employees have since resigned, but the SIU has got preservation orders in relation to their pensions. And that is in relation to the former head of the branch that used to be the State Attorney's Office in Johannesburg. There has been another employee whose pension has also been preserved. The other matters relate to external individuals against whom we cannot do consequent management.
there are quite a number of matters that have been flagged by the SIU relating to a practitioner in the Eastern Cape.
Mr. Pandalan, yes, we do have that information. In fact, we have met with the SIU, the NPA, twice, and then we have met with the SIU, the NPA, and the Hawks. I think it was our last, so we have met with them three times. We do have that background information, and we have agreed that we are going to be meeting with them twice a year. So we will be meeting with them, I think, by March, April. So we do have that. We do have that information. Don't go to that background. We do have it.
No. So in the main, Chairperson, that will in fact dispense of that issue. The other issue that Honourable Member Horn raised, the contingent liabilities and case management, I think the CFO did allude to the issue of both the contract management and the bid adjudication processes, so I'm not going to talk to that issue. However, I also need to indicate that if you look at page 36 of the slide, and I think it will be remiss of me not to also mention at this point that the policies that were in fact indicated as being en route to cabinet has been approved on the 9th of November, which is Tuesday. I think, Chairperson, you would be aware about that, and we were given clear instructions that the other two critical policies must be finalized, and those will be going through the process on the 18th of November. I think I will yield back to yourself and the DG to deal with the other residual issues, Chairperson. Thank you.
No, thank you. Mr. Pandalan, you're not yet done. I asked a question about
the Western Cape.
Yeah, that are not working at the Western Cape.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think it's not only the Western Cape that is impacted. Quite a number of offices are actually operating without the necessary resources. But I thought when the CFO is addressing that issue, because I signed off on the request relating to the Western Cape in January of 2021. I was there on Monday. I met with them, and the problem is still enduring. And I also note that that issue has not particularly been addressed, but we also have the Office of State Attorney in Pretoria that is also operating under the same circumstances. Now, I think I will not be able to do justice to that question because I rely on the transversal services. Perhaps this is an issue that the CFO ought to address, or alternatively, I could yield to the DG when it does sum up as to what is happening in that space, because all the processes have been adhered to, the request has been made. This is a transversal service in my space. I'm aware of the problems that are impacting the Office of State Attorney in Western Cape, as it is with the other offices of State Attorney, but I would not actually want to delve into each one, a single one of them, because requests in relation to procurement or extension of contracts have already been made and way back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. CFO, can you answer?
Thanks, Chair. I will have to investigate what actually transpired because, as the SG is correctly saying, I also learned just yesterday that also the State Attorney Pretoria office is also having a similar challenge. But what is also compounding the problem is that we don't have a national treasury transversal contract for Portugal machine in place, but I already instructed the team that we do need to go on three quotation basis so that we can then address that. As to the submission that the SG is speaking to, it did pass through my hands and it was accordingly processed. But as to why the machine is not there, it could be one, the issue that a service provider has been appointed by the service provider who does not have capacity to deliver, because that's the case with the also our Pretoria office. But it's a matter that I had indicated to the team that we need to collect the information with all the other offices who may be having a similar challenge of being impacted by the service provider who was unable to deliver, but was part of the transversal contract. But for those other offices that are affected, we're going to have to go a three-quotation route to have the photocopy machines available at least for a short-term period up until National Treasury has in place a transversal contract. But it's a matter that I'll take up personally to make sure that this issue is indeed resolved. Thank you.
CFO, do you think that your answer is it really fair to the people who are recipient of the service, of your service?
Chair, my answer would probably be not fair in a sense that people are without services, but my response also is also limited because this information, Chair, I'm just receiving now, particularly with Western Cape today. I did not know that the problem still persists there, but I am aware about Pretoria because I also learned about it yesterday. So. Hence, I would say, from a person who's not receiving services, my answer would probably be not fair. But from where I stand, if also I do not have information about challenges that colleagues are still having at their level, really, it's an answer I would also provide from my side, you know, to say, let me be given an opportunity so that these matters can be addressed as speedily as possible. Thank you, Chair.
When did you send the memo?
No, the memo was signed in January. So from where I stand, it went past me, yes. From where I stand, Chairperson, once the memo is off my hands, the services would need to be delivered. So I'm not too sure with Western Cape whether the case is that of one service provider forgotten its name, who was part of the transversal contract, whom purchase orders were issued, but when they were supposed to deliver services, they did not have capacity. Because that's the situation with Pretoria office. So that's why I'm saying I do need to investigate to say what actually transpired with Winston Cape, so that at least I'll be able to deal with this matter based on what actually transpired in Winston Cape. I do not have all the facts.
Did you know about Pretoria?
No, I only knew yesterday.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. I'll ask my colleague, Mr. Rasiro, to just broach it in brief, in less than 2 minutes, to speak to, I think, issues generally relating to performance information that the Auditor General might have picked up that were raised with one.
Thank you, Gigi. Thank you, Chairperson. On the issues related to the Auditor General's report regarding the reliability of information, I must say that we are addressing those issues. The recommendations by the AG are part of the interventions that we are putting in place to deal with control deficiencies that has been identified. So also internal audit is driving the implementation plan of the audit action plan, and the audit action plan implementation is also on the standard agenda item at management meetings as well as the EXCO, so that we can be able to monitor. So in terms of key interventions implemented already, Chairperson, on usefulness of reported performance information, we managed to review the current APPs so that we ensure compliance with the SMART criteria, as well as, I mean, with the aim of preventing the recurring audit findings. And on issues related to reliability of the reported performance information, We are currently testing the systems to ensure that we did not lose the data during the attack. We are also doing reconciliation of the source document against reports in order to ensure that the generated data by the system is validated or is valid, accurate, complete, so that we address the completeness and accuracy of the audit findings. I must also mention, Honorable Chairperson, that also we are reviewing our standard operation procedures so that we address the weaknesses in the processes. And by doing this, it will assist in strengthening the capturing and reviewing of our controls. Now, in terms of the issues of the BRR report, I think we acknowledge that we are late in terms of submission. We've been working on the report, and at some point it has been ready for submission. However, I think there was a communication breakdown in terms of ourselves and Parliament at some point regarding, during this month of September. But that report will be submitted as soon as possible. Thank you very much.
I think in the main, there are just few issues, even those that were directed to me that I think were covered. One, there was the issue of our bonus strategy. I think that was clarified. But part of what it is we did, some of the decisions that we take that make us unpopular. Or on bonus, I think we reduced the percentage of what was being recommended. So I wasn't sure about, in terms of the millions, how much that was going to be. Particularly the reason that I raised was the performance, that there had to be a correlation between the performance, the amount of performance bonus we paid, and the performance of the department. However, as they have explained, from level 1 to level 12, it's not necessarily the case. But we have also taken a decision that for senior management, for those years that the department did not perform well, there cannot be a bonus. So I think that's the decision we took. The Justice College, there was a question from Honorable Breckenbach about the master classes. One, I made a determination by the end of March that the department as a whole, we are running short of a project management skill. Now, we have conducted skills audit for the senior managers, and we are running the rest for the lower levels. So what the Justice College is doing with Masterclass, I guess Masterclass might well sound like a fancy name, is to do a project for all, a course for all of us in senior management. And so they will be taking us through training. And I think that's not an expensive exercise. With the one we did on change management, because there's a lot of programs on change that we're implementing. The Invest of Pretoria offered. So when I was appointed, it was on an alma mater that the principal offered that they want to assist us. So we did a change management course for free. And it's very important for us that the performance of the department will not improve without change management programs being implemented. And then it's important for us as senior managers to have that understanding, that to move from where we are to a situation where we perform better and serve the members of the public, we have to be taken through training. So you'll hear a lot about this master classes. Just simply say, it's not a course, the same course as someone who has to be accredited. But the Justice College has an accreditation for the course for a level of NQF level 4. So with the project management course, particularly, our target is that in the next 24 months, all 16,000 of us must have gone through project management. Because part of what I observe is what is called a low performance. In an ideal way, if we're taking a project management approach, we could well have been sitting above 75 or 85. Because most of the things that I saw is that by end of March is the end of the financial year, suddenly there's a stampede to want to complete projects. When in fact, if you take a project management approach, you know that if you have not completed what you're supposed to do by end of January, you run a risk. Because by the 15th of March, books are closing. So you can't stick to complete a project by March. So that's the reason why we have that. So we'll be having a lot of those courses. The reason why we're doing skills for this is part of our assessment of the strength, and our human capital capability. And obviously then that will be required that we go through some form of training. There was a question.
question on PPE corruption. I just got a report 2 days ago from our forensic audit team. The report identified some irregularities. However, it mentions that the officials that are supposed to be held accountable have unfortunately left the department due to early retirement. There was an issue around risk that Honorable Janchi had raised that we should have seen this. It was identified, ICT, as part of the risk of the department. And plans were being developed and so on and so forth to make sure that we mitigate the risk. But generally, I must say that based on the experience that I've had for that 7 weeks after the ransomware attack, and I apologize that when I mention the state of affairs as they are, I seem to horrify, but I think it is important that I tell the situation as is, even to my own parents, so that I don't come back next year and say, oh, but you could have told us that this is the situation. The cyber governance is not only a general challenge that is facing justice. I want to dare say that it's a general challenge that is facing government. And what am I basing that on? I'm basing on the fact that I'm having to deal with that challenge. If you were to ask, how many of the government departments were we able to draw on for them to come and assist us? There were one or two or few state agencies that came in. But that remains a challenge. You mentioned the $50 million that CARA has given to state security. That's for cyber response, a program. The colleagues are mentioning here, it's going into 3 years, that they have not yet requested that $50 million in terms of a program of action. So it's a broader challenge that that government has. But we are convinced that if we can implement the plans that we're having, we are next week retreating to specifically just develop and finalize a program to go on modernization and deal generally with the programs relating to ICT. You will have seen part of the under expenditure related to the integrated justice system, which is a modernization program itself. That program as well was run on contract. So there was a project management office which was based on contracts. So it was more about awarding contracts and people coming in to run those contracts. And that's the part we're trying to stabilize, to develop internal capacity in order to manage that. And it's part of the reason why you had an under expenditure there. But our focus now is to say that program of necessity has to capacitate justice, Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, as a critical part of the justice value chain. There was a question of whether we would consider utilizing consultancy. I attended the portfolio committee when the Department of Correctional Services, our sister department, presented, and I saw that they got out of a qualified situation through the use of consultants. And I must admit to you that it is tempting for us as well to consider that. We will engage with them and learn what the cost is. If engaging consultants will assist us to reduce the amount of wasteful, fruitless, irregular expenditure at a low cost, and based on the model that they have used to assist them, I must say that we will seriously consider it. Unfortunately, the 1 million now on the consultant on gender mainstreaming, no one is able to account for it. Apparently, it's not known by anyone, even the colleagues that are responsible for gender. So we'll have to go and dig and try to understand what was that 1 million paid for and come back to. I think, Chair, we have tried to the best of our ability to respond to the questions that we have, unless if there are those specifically that we might have missed, we can deal with them. But that's our response, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, I don't see any further hands. There's Honorable Janji. Now, Chair, I guess all other members are satisfied with their questions that they will answer. They don't want to come back, so Honorable Janji will be the last one. Well, thank you, Chair. It's a very quick point, Chair, and it relates to the last point of the DG. But I have to say thank you for the responses from all of them. Under your leadership, we're going to be watching the space, as we know. We've noted everything else. We follow up these to different sessions. But I wanted to comment on the last point, Chair, because the annual report that has been written by the annual report, let me give you specifics. It says 301 days, okay? 303 days were spent on this gender mainstreaming with that amount of a million. It can't be that nobody here knows about this 1 million. It's in the annual report. It's in the annual report under the utilization of consultants. Maybe they can go and check that section. That's where we read it. It's not a thumbs up, the chair that got it somewhere else. It's in the annual report. I would have also made the point, because I also noted that down. 303 days for 1 million for gender mainstreaming. They might not need to respond, but I just wanted to make the point that this is not a some unknown thing. You brought it to us, so you cannot be able to explain it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janche. I think we are the last speaker on this issue. No, thank you very much, DG.
Chairperson, excuse me, I wrote on the chat, I was trying to, but it's only one clarification, Chair. Not long. Only one, Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. The question that I would like to ask is in connection with the issue of these officials that when they are about to be or suspended or about to go for disciplinary, they leave the department and resign. And a lot of money has been used, and which is aligned to them, which is attached to the Chair. I just want to find out, is it possible that even if that official decided to go, is it not possible for the department, for example, themselves to submit the case to the SIU or what? Or do they have to wait for such occasions where they have to come and report? Is there no other means that can be done immediately so that even their pensions maybe are being held, you know, in hold for whatever matter to be settled? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jolie. DJ?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think it's a matter that we, based now on the observations we are making, it is becoming a fashionable tendency. I think of close to 5 cases, we are seeing that. So it's a matter that we'll work on to make sure that where there are specific cases that have financial implications, where colleagues might be responsible, that we coordinate efforts so that even if they leave, we still have the ability to recoup in case any form of an investigation points to a possible impropriety on their part. Because it happened as well with disciplinary hearings. After hearings have been running for almost 6 months, and then, you know, the officials decided to terminate. But in those cases as well, specifically, we did check whether there was something that financially could be associated. But in some cases, it would be very complicated. But the matter that I'm saying we would need to work on and keep an eye on so that it doesn't become a practice that whenever officials are supposed to be held accountable, then they take an option of terminating the relationship with the partner.
Okay, DJ.
Thank you, Chair.
This thing has been there since I joined Parliament,
this thing has been there. I don't think that is something that is starting now. That people, when they are faced with a disease or they are involved in corruption, then they resign. And from long time ago, the view has always been, well, if there is a criminal activity taking place, we should make criminal charges.
Yes, Chair. We'll follow up on that, Chair. There are recent ones that I think the one part that I'm referring to, I think on the PPE, when I look at the time that the official left, I think we were disadvantaged by the amount of time it took to conclude the report. But as for the other cases, yes, I take that responsibility that we'll have to make sure that we coordinate the effort so that colleagues just don't leave without having to be held accountable by all other people.
Thank you very much. Is the Deputy Minister still around?
Yes, Chair, I'm still here.
Okay, can we give you this opportunity to have your concluding remarks on this issue?
No, Chair, I think it's been quite an exhaustive session, so I don't really have anything to say at this point.
Well, thank you very much. I think you would be aware, Deputy Minister, DG and the team, that from 2016, in 2016-2017 financial year, your performance was at 85%. The following year, it went to 74. Then the following year, it went to 73. Then 51. Then now it is 66. So you, I think you understand why we are so worried. And we are so worried. Deputy Minister, can you mute yourself? I think you will understand why we are so worried. But we have seen that you have responded in detail to the issues raised by the Auditor General. But what we would like you to do, in your responses, in those detailed responses, we would want a situation where you detail what, when, and by whom, so that that is submitted to the committee, so that early next year we are able to have quarterly meetings with yourselves to check progress, because the year starting from 31st March next year, after that year, we want a clean audit. We want a clean audit from the department. We don't want to give you a blanket check anymore because we don't believe that a clean audit is an accolade. A clean audit should be the minimum standards to show that government is properly functioning and is accounting for the resources given to it by the citizen. So we don't accept that departments under our stable don't have clean audits, especially justice. Now, we know we are demanding it. We can see that it is achievable. Because if you can focus, on those contingent liabilities, we think that it is achievable. So we will be meeting with you every 3 months for progress reports. We want your commitments to put them in a sort of a project plan that is what, who, when, how. And then we will also, from our side, we will go through the questions that the members have asked, so that we are in a position to ensure that we have a common program of monitoring you and assisting you to achieve better performance. We would want you to go beyond 85%. There are areas where if there is no performance by the Department of Justice, like the Master's Office and many other areas where our people are directly impacted. For us, it is not a matter of percentages. Whether it's 66 or it's 85, it's not a matter of percentages. It is a matter of qualitative service delivery to our people, changing the lives of our people. As long as that does not happen, you can have the most beautiful reports and the most eloquent way of justifying why things have not been done. That is irrelevant. As long as there are many tools where you go, when you go to the master's office, for us, is a sore point. So we want to help. We want to work with you. And we will be doing this on a quarterly basis to ensure that by the time we leave in 2024, the department would have provided better services than it is doing now. There are areas where we can see that we have there is serious improvement. We are seeing the energy. We are happy with the energy you are putting. But energy alone, without results, it just becomes an exercise. So we would want to see results. This issue, Deputy Minister, I think you will need to raise it also with the Minister and the Cabinet. This issue of the model, it's worrying us. It's worrying us seriously. Because what it does, it allows the judiciary to develop something that is going to be ultimately be a tradition and be an accepted norm of accountability, their own accountability model, which has not been generally agreed to. But as long as it is continuing, it is going to be taken as if it is something that has been generally agreed to. They are doing it because the executive is dragging its feet. We can't be singing about a model that has not come to fruition for so many years. And when they start doing their own thing, they are justified to do that because our processes are not coming to fruition. So please raise it. That issue that must be finalized soon, so that we can have a system or a model of accountability that is accepted or that is legally binding to everybody. Because the situation now is quite a difficult one. It's quite a difficult one. But thank you very much for spending the whole day with us today. And we know that the end. DPP and her team have been here since morning, but they are the direct beneficiaries of whatever the Department of Justice is doing, or sometimes they will be the victims if things are not going wrong. So I think it was good for them to be part of the meeting and to listen to what the Department of Justice is also doing. Thank you very much. Can I suggest that what time should we start with the NPA? Because members have not had time, no board has had time to eat. But what time should we start with the NPA?
Honorable Chief, I suggest 2:45.
245. Is there any disagreement to that?
Supported.
Supported. Can you start at 245 with the NTA? Thank you very much, Department of Justice. But it is in your interest that you must
leave. Recording stopped. Recording in progress.
It is in your interest that you must listen to what the NPA has to say, because it is part of the department. It is part of the, it's a program in the department. So this thing of people coming, presenting and leaving is what is building silo mentalities within government. So it will be important that you stay also, since they stayed the whole day listening to you. Thank you very much.
Recording stopped.